Hey guys, before we jump into this episode, I just wanted to let everybody know that our episode on The Matrix Resurrections is now available to Beyond the Screenplay patrons. So just head to the link in the show notes, or if you're watching on YouTube, just click the little pop-up in the top right corner to go straight to that episode on Patreon. Now, let's jump into our conversation about Die Hard. I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today we are talking about the 1988 film Die Hard, also known as Home Alone for Grownups, screenplay by Jeb Stuart and Stephen E. D'Souza, based on the novel by Roderick Thorpe and directed by John McTiernan. I'm joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Rand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Yippee-ki-yay, Michael Tucker.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
How did I not see that coming?
It's perfect. Yeah, so easy.
It's right there. Oh, God. Excellent. So here we are. We're going to talk about Die Hard. First, a couple updates. So this is the last fresh podcast that we are recording this year. You are listening to this listener on December 24th or afterward. And next week for the New Year's Eve release, we're going to be pulling one of our episodes from our Patreon vault. So our episode on Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse will be available for everyone to hear. Just one of many excellent films and hopefully excellent episodes that are available to patrons. So you can look for that next week. And we're also going to, in January, do a couple fun things. So we're going to be doing our What We're Watching series on The Book of Boba Fett, which is going to, I think, generate lots of interesting conversation. There will be lots of thoughts had and discussed. And then also in January, we are going to be doing our trilogy on The Godfather trilogy as per our getting past 1,000 patron goal on Patreon, which is really exciting. So a lot of things going on to look forward to in the new year. And it's crazy that we're here. Another year has passed. And now we're going to talk about Die Hard.
Yes.
So Trisha's very excited. This is a movie from the 80s. And despite that, it's pretty good. I watched it for the first time 3 years ago, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, because there was talk about doing a Lessons from a Screenplay video on it, and people were talking about it and requesting it, and, you know, is it a Christmas movie? Is it not a Christmas movie? We're going to talk about that only for the next hour. I'm sure everyone would love that. But I watched it, and I was like, yeah, okay, it's fine. I see why people probably like it a lot. I have issues with the 80s, as we've said, but it is also well known for kind of being like a perfect action movie and structurally being very sound, and the pacing is really good and all the stuff that I appreciated much more the second time around. So I went in to this kind of ready to be a little humbug about it, but found myself enjoying it moment to moment. So that's been my journey with Die Hard. Trisha, do you want to tell us about your journey with Die Hard?
Sure. So I also saw this as an adult, for sure. It would have been in the winter of 2008. And by that, I mean like January, February, winter of 2008. I was seeing this guy, and I don't even know, because like literally nothing ever happened except that we watched all the Die Hard movies and ate a lot of pizza. And like, I think that was the extent of our relationship, and maybe it was the most perfect relationship I've ever been a part of. But
they're like, definitely worse relationships.
One of us had ever seen any Die Hard movies. And I think we went on like 4 dates and they were just all Die Hard movies. It was so good. Like, I don't know. It was just really, really fun. I love action movies. That is well documented. These are some of the best around, especially this one. Like, it really introduced this new kind of action hero to us. You know, Bruce Willis, in the way that we think of him now, is John McClane, right? Like, the Bruce Willis prototype was created in this movie. And everybody wanted to cash in on it because it was so relatable. It was so successful after this movie came out. And so it just kind of changed the way that Hollywood was thinking about action blockbusters and what they are and the kinds of leading men and the kinds of villains that could be like facing off against them. It's such a landmark movie for so many reasons. You know, the containment is a factor that I can't wait to talk to you guys about because I like wanted to write a video about containment for the channel. And this is like one of the best, most contained action, you know, thrillers, I guess, comedies. I think Brian pointed out that back then all action movies were also kind of comedies in some ways. Yeah, there was a flippancy to action. But yeah, there's so much that's so, I don't know, I was just going to say effective, but that doesn't feel like, there's so much that's just so fun. What a ride this movie is from start to finish. And so I don't know, I just really enjoy it. I like all the Die Hard movies. I'm not that discerning when it comes to like action movies, as long as there's some good action. But this one is so good. And I do basically watch it every Christmas season. So very thrilled to be here. Nice. Glad we finally have gotten you into a chair, Michael, and forcing you to talk about it.
Yeah. Yes. Here we are. Excellent. Cool.
In chairs.
Okay. Yes, here we are in chairs. Brian, from your chair, what are your feelings on Die Hard?
I love this movie, love this franchise. I have no idea when the first time I saw it was, but it's just one of those movies that feels like it's always been there, you know. Love the third movie too, Die Hard with a Vengeance, with Sam Jackson and
very good
Jeremy Irons as Simon Gruber, if I remember correctly. I think the like trivia is that most of the Die Hard sequels were not written as Die Hard movies, but then they were just like, but what if it was John McClane? And they're like, all right. Like, that's how like Die Hard with a Vengeance came up. It wasn't supposed to be Hans's brother. It was just like, but yeah, so I've seen it many times. And it's a movie I always come to when I try to think of a movie that's like a perfect movie that's also not trying to do anything other than be a movie. And like, I've said sometimes, like, oh, you can have a movie like Die Hard and people are like, whoa, 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 Die Hard's great. I'm like, no, it's great. It's just not trying to do anything other than entertain you for 2 hours. Like, there's some light thematic content, obviously, as like any movie should have, but it's not, no one making this movie is thinking, I really hope the viewer goes away from this really thinking about their life or anything. It's just like, here is a solid piece of entertainment for you. And it just absolutely works.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. Yeah. Okay. So Alex, what about you? When did you see this movie?
I'm kind of in the same boat as you, Michael, where it just passed me by in my youth. I was never shown it, or I never saw it alongside the James Bond movies or, you know, Star Wars, all these other franchises that were just always a part of my consciousness. This was not one of them. And watching it, I think I just watched it for the first time a couple of years ago. When I watched it, I was like, oh man, if I had seen this when I was, you know, that like, I don't know, like 10 years old, early teens, whatever, you know, that kind of still a kid, but kind of becoming a preteen age, it totally could have been in that pantheon of those movies that have always been with me, but I didn't. And so I saw from that more, just jaded adult perspective of watching a classic 80s movie. But I, you know, especially revisiting it, like you said, Michael, I was able to now watch it just thinking about what this movie changed and what this movie put into place, all the tropes, all the Bruce Willis style action hero, you know, the bad guy and all of his henchmen are so distinctive in a way that is, I think I've seen, you know, replicated, but never quite as well, you know, in some ways. It started this genre of, you know, the everyman lone guy in the contained space against the invaders. You know, I think about, Con Air, or just, you know, a lot of different types of like vehicles or places you put people in with a bad guy, like keeping them there. That, like, this kind of started that. So I do think it is a landmark action movie in a lot of ways because of it pivoted away from, I think, a different type of 80s action movie, where they, it was, you know, Rambo or just these kind of, or Arnold Schwarzenegger, just like these gigantic, like almost impossible men who are like don't really have a personality, but John McClane is all personality, and he's just a New York cop. He's just a regular guy who's in this weird situation, and he thinks it's crazy too, and he's, you know, making quips about how nuts this all is the whole time. So, and Bruce Willis, I just got to say, like, Bruce Willis is really hot in this movie. I don't think I'd ever really appreciated or seen like super hot Bruce Willis, and I get it.
Yeah. I love how when they're landing on the plane at the beginning, the stewardess is like, oh, hi. Uh-huh. He's walking by with his bear.
And I just appreciate how they just make him take off more and more of his clothes as the movie goes on.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm fine with it.
Thank you, John McTiernan.
Yeah, it's actually a funny thing that, you know, like this movie was offered to Schwarzenegger and Stallone and sort of like all of the normal people. And Bruce Willis at the time was David Addison on Moonlighting. Like he was sort of a comic TV actor. But as you're pointing out, Alex, his personality being brought into this movie is what makes Die Hard Die Hard. I mean, the script and everything is great, but it's like, but what if instead of a Stallone or a Schwarzenegger, we had this sort of muscular, good-looking, you know, action guy, but who's also cracking jokes and just, you know, fist with your toes, like just like everything is kind of a ridiculous joke to him.
About him, the way he looks, there were multiple shots where I was like, Bradley Cooper, like I think he looked like Bradley Cooper, and I think he could do like a side by side in some of the shots, and it was like, I don't know, to me it felt very similar. But yeah, as you guys are saying, his performance adds so much to it. And it's more impressive given the fact that he doesn't have scenes with people. He's talking to himself, essentially, for most of the movie. But it's like believable and compelling. And it's somehow in this weird zone where he can make these quips and these one-liners that doesn't, like, it feels like he is saying it for himself to entertain himself and not like he's looking at the camera and making a joke for the audience. Right. And that's somehow, that's a hard line to walk. And I think he does it very well.
Well, I was thinking a lot about that this time around, and maybe we can spend a few minutes talking about the exposition, of which there is so much. And this movie handles it really interestingly. And some of it definitely feels expository now when you watch it. We're like, well, we gotta hear about all the safe measures at Nakatomi Plaza, and we gotta hear
seven
about
locks,
like, or yeah, exactly, and yeah, all the different mechanics that are in place, and that certainly doesn't, it's handled as gracefully as possible, but it still feels a little bit crowbarred in there. But the device of having a character who talks to himself is a really difficult device to pull off.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that this movie establishes it so early on, right? Where he's essentially, especially because he essentially needs to be kind of a reticent character who doesn't want to talk to people, right? He kind of needs to have this chip on his shoulder and this, like, doesn't really want to be here ever, which is part of his charm, right? Where it's like John McClane does not want to be the hero of this movie. He's very, very reluctant hero. And he doesn't want to make friends with strangers. He's not here to impress Holly's boss. He's not here to, like, you know, charm her coworkers or get dressed up for this party. He doesn't want to do any of that. He doesn't want to be here in the first place. And so having a character that doesn't want to talk, but then basically needs to talk to himself the entire movie is a really risky thing to do. And I really like the different, like, little moments that the movie sprinkles in early on where he is kind of talking to himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple where he sees at the airport, right? The, like, young woman runs up to her boyfriend and he jumps into her boyfriend's arms. And, you know, John McClane looks at her and is like, oh, California. And he says almost exactly the same thing at the party, right? Like, some stranger comes up to him at the Nakatomi party and kisses him and it tells him Merry Christmas. And he's like, oh, California, and, like, wipes off his face. That's that's, those moments are so small, but they're so critical because he isn't talking to anybody but himself, right? He's not looking into camera. He's not looking at somebody else in the room. He's just kind of talking to himself because he feels awkward or he's a little overwhelmed and doesn't know what to make of the situation. And so I think those little moments are crucial. There's another one too, where he's going to find Holly's name on the like screen finder. And he sees that it's not under her married name. And he's just like, oh, Jesus Christ, I think is what he says. And he doesn't say to the desk guard, oh, it's under her maiden name. I can't believe she changed it. He makes a realistic comment, but it is to himself. And then it sets us up later for when we hear, you know, he's going to confront Holly about it. So there's lots of little moments like that that make it grounded enough that when he's, you know, full on in an air vent going like, come out to the coast, we'll have a few laughs. Like, we're ready for it by that point because we've seen him talking to himself so much by then.
I will say in general, what you're getting at too is just how efficient the first act is at setting up the characters and their dilemma, you know, the issue with him and his wife, and all of that is really well done and done so efficiently and so quickly. So that when he gets to that, you know, they only have like one scene together, him and his wife, where he's washing up in the corporate bathroom or whatever. And by that moment, we already kind of know everything about them, and they have that little flare up, and it's all we need to understand, you know, where they are in the relationship, what the problem is. And so that's all we need to for the rest of the movie until the very end.
I think maybe the best line of exposition in this movie is when she says to the, you know, to the housekeeper, let's make up the spare bedroom. Cause that tells you two very important things. One, they're separated. Two, they're friends. He can stay in the spare bedroom, right? It's not like, oh God, he's in town or whatever, you know? And I just love that it's like so much is communicated about their relationship by just basically one sentence, which is like, he is staying here, but not with me, which I love that.
Yeah. And that during that scene, that one scene that they have where they're interrupted, right, by that couple at the party that's like looking for a place to, you know, be naughty or whatever.
Yeah, 80s corporate party.
Yeah.
Right. Even that was like, that's not really exposition, but it's kind of, it's doing scene work of like juxtaposition of like these two people. John and Holly are estranged and they're trying to figure out what their relationship is. And for a moment, like a young couple that's like, you know, in love, lust, whatever with each other barges in, and like just as they leave, that's kind of hanging in the room and providing like that extra context. And so it was just like a little moment where I was like, that didn't need to be in there, but it makes everything better just by having that moment. And it does like pacing things at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. And that scene where they're having essentially a fight is really smart because it's just the classic textbook. If you're going to do exposition, do it in conflict where it's like, well, you weren't supportive. We had this argument 6 months ago. And it's like, you didn't care what it did to the kids and like our marriage. And it's telling us the timeline of the backstory, but it's doing it embedded in conflict. So the first time you hear it, you don't bump on it. You're just thankful for that information where you're just like, oh, thank you. It was 6 months ago. Great. Now I know. It's actually, it's a little less graceful in the scene with Argyle in the car, but it's still conflict. Where it's like, he doesn't want to tell Argyle.
Right. Like, put an Argyle in your movie and if you do it just right, he will manage to somehow get all the exposition out in a way that is enjoyable, but clearly doing lots of exposition very quickly.
Yes.
Well, and before we leave that scene with him and Holly, I also really appreciate that he immediately beats himself up about it afterwards.
Yeah.
Like, that also really endears us to him. And you know, if he was just stubborn and wasn't hearing her, and, you know, totally thought he was in the right, then I'd be on Holly's side. But the fact that he's already beating himself up about it, he knows he's kind of wrong, he's screwing this up, makes us like him.
And talk about little moments where he's talking to himself. That's a really, like, that's one of the bigger, more on-the-nose moments where he's like, real smooth, John, great job, you know?
Right.
That sets us up for that moment later where he's like, why didn't you stop him after Nakatomi. No, not Nakatomi. What's his name? Mr. Takagi is shot. Where he has like a full-on conversation with himself, like enacting both parts, having an argument of like, why didn't you stop him? Because then you'd be dead too. It's like that little moment where he's beating himself up about Holly is already prepping us for that moment later where he's beating himself up for not saving Mr. Takagi's life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's something, because I really bump when characters talk to themselves in movies, and I didn't even think about how much John talks to himself in this movie, and I think that's because it's constant. So it's just like, as you said a couple times, Trisha, it's just like, it introduces it right away, little tiny things he says, so by the time he's having full conversations with himself, you're like, yeah, that's what this character does. And I think what it bothers me is when, you know, an hour into a movie, a character suddenly says something to themselves, and it just feels like so weird and like no one would ever say that, you know, but this movie just sort of peppers it in, you know, it's in the writing, but it's also in the performance where it just like some people can pull that off and other people can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is kind of a topic change here, but one thing that was fun watching at this time was thinking about how this is, you know, the end of the 80s, right before a lot of my favorite 90s movies like Terminator 2 or Jurassic mm-hmm. Park, and seeing kind of like the origin of just these tropes that appear in a lot of my favorite movies, you know, like the corporate office building space, you know, T2 has this whole shootout mm-hmm. craziness in that same kind of space. And I get a lot of those vibes from Die Hard. The automation of everything, you know, the idea that a hacker can go in and like, mm-hmm. turn off all the elevators and like all the gates are going to come down and the whole park is going to be, you know, electrified fences are down. Very Jurassic Park in that way. Mm-hmm. The name Gennaro can only exist in the right. world of Jurassic Park. And it was very disturbing that it was in this movie. So that's just another fun thing to when you watch kind of the end of the 80s, it is for those of us who, you know, the early 90s was like the time when cinema became a part of our consciousness. It's fun to go back a little bit earlier and see, oh, there's these tropes, things that are already kind of coming into play in movies like Die Hard.
Mm. Yeah. 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 It was interesting to look at his filmography. So the John McTiernan, the director, and mm-hmm. to see that he did The Hunt for Red October, which was recently on my top 90s list, but also Last Action Hero. And I loved Last Action Hero and saw that a lot. And someday it'd be fun to talk about it. But it was interesting to see that he was, for people that don't know, Last Action Hero is kind of like a parody action mm-hmm. film that's kind of investigating and pulling apart the idea of what an action movie is. And it was weird to then see like, oh, he's the guy that did Die Hard also. Uh-huh. So he kind of created this thing that later he's like dissecting. And Die Hard was, as we're talking about, already kind of a reaction to other action movies. So I feel like there was just a lot more of that context in my head this watch through, and like you're saying, Alex, you know, understanding the influence it had on other things. And so I was really paying attention to the action and how it very methodically and at the right pace builds up and up. Like it doesn't start with like a huge explosion and big things. Like there's a very nice pacing, and you know, like we're saying, it makes us care about the characters in the first act, but it gives us enough to know that like, ooh, bad things are coming. And it also cares a lot about us being able to track every step of his journey, of John's mm-hmm. journey in this like mm-hmm. battle, where it matters how many terrorists there are. He has them written down on his wrist so he can know the names. Like we know the names by the end. It's such a different way to approach action, where it's like every one of these people will matter. So it's not just going to be people shooting randomly at, you know, red shirts that are falling out of the sky or whatever. Right. Like everything has a purpose, and we know where we are in every step of that journey. And it feels like really unique. Like lots of other movies have done it pretty well, but there is something special about Die Hard that, to me anyway, really stands out. It's like, this is a really nicely contained and measured and fun action movie, and I understand very much now why that is such a big deal.
It feels almost archetypal in a way. Like it's mm-hmm. just, it's like here is like the good solid version of all of the good things that this kind of action movie should have. And you kind of can't argue with the way this movie does those things. Like, the bad guy is a great bad guy. You know, Alan Rickman, so good. The henchmen all have their like things, and they've got, you know, different desires and their personality quirks that makes them memorable. You've got like kind of side stories, like subplots. A reporter comes into play like midway through the movie, and there's like a reporter's subplot. So the movie keeps kind of getting more and more layered and more complex, and the feds are here. It just kind of does it all, but like you said, Michael, it doesn't do it too much, and we don't devolve into just chaos where nothing matters anymore and Bruce Willis is invincible and all the stakes are gone. It keeps that moderation so that up until the end, the stakes are high and things could happen to John McClane or his wife. We believe that something bad could happen.
Well, it's really cleverly paced is the thing. Like, you mentioned this just a second ago, Michael, but it doesn't rush to get us into an action sequence before it needs to. It takes its time with John and Holly. We take our time getting to the party. You know, we set all the exposition in place. But in a movie that was going to cover more ground in terms of time, like in a movie that would take place over a week or two, like most films do, the timeline of most feature movies is a couple days to a couple months, right? Like, most films don't span more than a couple months worth of time. And a couple weeks is pretty much average, where it's like, here's a little season in a character's life where they like learn a little thing, right? And when you have these unique movies with this sort of really, really abbreviated timeline, you have to prepare the audience for that. And so, you know, in a normal movie, we would just cut from, say, John landing at the airport. We'd have that first scene on the plane, maybe, right? If it was really important that we needed to see that the character doesn't like flying or anything. Although that in itself is just a really smart way. The first thing we know about John McClane is that he's nervous and like not a tough guy all the way down, right? Like, I just love that as like a little, it's his snakes, you know, he's Indiana Jones and doesn't like snakes. But we might have that opening scene on the plane, but then we would probably cut to the party and he's at like, going up and talking to Holly at the party, right? That would be the next scene that we would cut to, because in a normal movie, we need to move along. We need to get to the A plot, which is, you know, or his character arc plot, which is his relationship with his wife. So we would not ride in the car with Argyle. We would not walk into the lobby and search for the name on the thing. We would not look around at all the elevators. We would not talk to any strangers at the party or meet Ellis or anything. We wouldn't do any of that. And so the movie is signaling to us by how long it's taking to get through the events just leading to that conversation with his wife that, settle in, everybody. This movie is not going to zip through the night. In fact, we're not going anywhere. This is the pacing of the movie. Every detail is important. Pay attention. And I think it's so brilliant. Like, if you're going to do this kind of contained all-in-one-night thriller, or, you know, it'd be hard to imagine a timeline that's even shorter than this one. But if you're going to do it, you need to really prepare the audience to just like sit back and listen up. And that's a real challenge to do. And this movie just has the confidence to do it. And it's like, hey, you just met these characters and we still have, you know, like we're sitting in the car with Argyle. We're talking about the whole thing and her job and her career. And it takes a while, but it really works. And I just think that, like, yeah, if you have a pacing thing, you need to prepare the audience for the pacing. Whatever the pacing is going to be, just get us ready within the first few seconds if you can.
And all the people that we meet along the way, as you're saying, we're going step by step by step. Every person except for the weird guy on the airplane comes back and pays off and has a role to play in the story. And so I think that, you know, there's no way for us to really know that consciously while it's happening. But like you're saying, there is this confidence to the way it's all unfolding that I think subconsciously clues us in to, like, you know, this isn't just a car ride with a random guy that we're never going to see again. Like, Argyle is maybe going to be an important part, and that's why we're spending a little bit more time than we might otherwise on these scenes and on these moments.
And at the same time, it doesn't linger too long, right? I checked, did a time check this time around when the terrorist van pulls into the parking garage, and it's at 14 minutes and like 45 seconds. It's on like the 15 page mark. This is your inciting incident. Here we go. And so it knows how to, like, the pacing is textbook perfect for the sort of microcosm or like micro timeline that this movie is.
Yeah.
And with what you're saying, Michael, about like, you kind of know these characters are kind of come back. I'd be curious to sort of analyze each one of those introductory scenes and see what clues we get. I think Argyle's an easy one because it ends with like, just hang out, you know, I'll hang out and here's my number. And so it's like, okay, the movie is telling you this character is still in the mix, basically, as opposed to if you just had like a weird limo ride and then an hour later that character shows up again, you're like, oh right, that character from earlier, you know. But I'd be curious to see how often that the movie does those little things, those little hints, like this is just the beginning of his story. Because also we just inherently as film watchers understand that too. You can sort of tell when a movie is telling you this is a character who is being introduced and they're going to come back later versus this is just a little one-off scene that is, you know, is not going to have a bigger effect. But then you also get disoriented when a movie is not telling you which it's doing, right? So you have a movie sometimes where you're just like, I'm getting a bunch of new characters and I have no idea whether any of these people are going to come back or whether they're important. But as you guys are saying, this movie is just sort of like introducing people with the understanding that they are all going to come together in the third act in some shape or form.
Yeah.
Well, in action movies, you need colorful characters that we can that we can get a really strong image of right away, because we aren't going to spend a lot of time with them, but they're going to become important, right? And the more colorful the character, the longer they're going to be in the movie, probably. Right? So like Argyle is really colorful. He's going to be here until the end. Same thing with Theo. That guy makes it forever in this movie because he's really colorful. He's very strange and has this whole deal going on that Theo's a really interesting character.
He's like the hacker guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What's the name of the blonde, long-haired German?
Carl.
Yeah.
Carl.
Yep. Again, he has a whole like visual thing. And all three of these characters I just mentioned have a strong visual, you know, thing to them too, where it's like they all have sort of their distinctive look that is, you know, kind of not what we expect, or like, yeah, really interesting. And then you have 80s. Characters. Mm. Ellis is another really great example.
Gotta have the guy that you're rooting is gonna die as soon as possible.
God, I really hope this guy dies. Yeah, but he has a really, you know, colorful entrance, and he's such a jerk in that scene, where the very first scene where we meet him. And so I think that's another, I don't know, little mini lesson I was taking away as I was going along. I was like, these are big personalities, and we grasp that within seconds of seeing each one of them, and that signals to us how important they are or will be as the movie goes along.
And then if we want to talk about colorful characters, now I have a machine gun. Hans Gruber, like, best villain of all time. Alan Rickman, amazing. Or should I say Bill Clay? God. Oh, you're one of them. Oh, God.
His fake accent voice is so specific and strange and amazing.
Apparently they wrote that scene so Alan Rickman could have an American accent for a scene.
Oh, my God. Well, yeah, he like commits to it so hard.
Yeah, yeah. It's so perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. The design of Hans Gruber is really interesting, and kind of the way that John McClane doesn't feel like a sort of stereotypical action hero, like hyper masculine, I'm not afraid of anything. Like Hans Gruber feels like he has a third dimension to him and is likable and like charming in his own kind of weird way, and is smart and clever in a similar way that like John McClane is smart and clever. So it's like, if it was just a generic terrorist person or whatever, obviously it wouldn't be fun because you don't get the kind of chess game that is being played weirdly between these two people. And that was something I was picking up on a lot more this time also, is that we see them interact with all these colorful characters around them in really interesting ways, and that helps their characterization. And it's cool that their characterization is that of somewhat unique personas given the situation they find themselves in.
Mm. Well, and they do embody, I mean, they say it very explicitly, you know, Hans Gruber is always talking to him about how he's an American cowboy, and Hans Gruber is like, you know, an educated European. And so it's kind of like two different kinds of smarts. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the, I am just intellectually smart. I am superior. I have a perfect plan. Look how stupid these Americans are. They're going to turn off the power right on schedule so the lock opens. Whereas John McClane is kind of like street smart. I'm going to think on my feet, NYPD cop smart. And so it's kind of these two archetypes of, you know, street smarts versus, you know, evil genius smarts going head to head. And the movie in general feels, yeah, there's this really interesting just cultural thing happening there where, yeah, John McClane is such an American character and embodying, I don't know, it feels very much like, I'm not sure what the movie is saying exactly, but it's almost trying to say like, this is what is special about kind of an American street sense kind of sensibility that is different from like this intellectual class that Hans Gruber represents. I don't know if that's, there's anything more to unpack there, but I was really struck by how it was called attention to a few times in the movie, mm-hmm. by Hans especially.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking that kind of connects to earlier, I forget exactly what you were saying, Tricia, but talking about John McClane and his kind of, he has a sort of improvisational way of solving things. Mm, he kind of feels Indiana Jones-ish in that way, yes. Where he sort of jumps into a situation with kind of half a plan and then figures the rest of it out kind of along the way. And we kind of, it's fun for us to go on that journey with him. And because of his personality, which is a little bit, you know, not flippant, but, you know, there's humor to it and the way that there's humor in Indiana Jones.
It's a dark humor. It's like a gallows humor almost, where he's like, I'm not going to make it out of here, you know, kind of thing.
It's like a coping mechanism, you know, basically. Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's like, I'm going to make these jokes because this is so horrible and I'm terrified.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that it almost feels like an Indiana Jones, but in 1988 in Los Angeles in a terrorist takeover building, or also
Spielberg, if you're listening, please do not make that movie. we're getting close to that timeline where
oh boy, whoa, that's weird to think about.
Well, I think the thing about Hans Gruber is that he has to be both likable and really menacing, right? Because he almost in some ways, I'm not going to say he's a secondary protagonist, but he carries so much of this movie. There are quite a few scenes that, it's not half the scenes, but there's a lot that John McClane is not in. And we are privileged as the audience. There's an interesting POV thing happening where we are with Hans and we are aware from the very outset that he has a very elaborate plan that he is super confident about. And it raises this curiosity in the mind of the viewer where we want John to stop the plan. We obviously want him to stop the plan and beat the terrorists, but we also are curious about what the plan is. Like, why is Hans so consistently not that flustered? Like, he's mildly annoyed most of the time. And the only time he really starts to get worried is when, you know, John McClane takes the detonators. But even then, he's kind of still like, no, just, you know, lock him in the elevator shaft. He'll be fine. No, just ignore him. Like, definitely determined and like, oh, the cops are here. It's a little earlier than normal, but don't even worry about it. He's every time there's a wrinkle and we are in John McClane's point of view where we're like, oh, yeah, the cops are here. Like, thank goodness it's going to all unravel now. And then we cut back to Hans Gruber and Hans isn't that worried. And so it has this propulsion to it where we're hoping that John McClane is going to stop him, but it's that, it, you know, enjoyable, pure entertaining factor of watching people who are equally matched, right? Opponents who are equally matched. I think you said it was a chess game, Michael. It is. And so, like, we're aware that John McClane doesn't have an elaborate plan, but he is very sharp and quick and, you know, can mess things up because he's very creative at problem solving and very street smart, all the things we're saying. He's definitely going to be able to mess things up. But we also do want to see the plan unfold. And so the move, counter move rhythm of the whole entire second act of this, which is what the whole entire second act of it is, after the break into two, it's like, it's a move, counter move, back and forth. And each one of those is usually like a really fun action sequence, right? A little mini action sequence where John McClane takes out a couple more terrorists. But those moves and counter moves are entertaining to watch because of who Hans is and because of who John McClane is, but also that trajectory of the plan, which the POV sets us up for. And there are ways that they keep the momentum going and reminding us that the plan is still happening, right? Where it's like, okay, Theo, where are you? How many locks do you have undone? Okay, we need to get those detonators back. Okay, we always knew the cops were going to be here. Okay, here are the radicals we want released from prison. And he's like, I don't really care about that. We are told that right away. So the script is constantly directing us to what is most important, which is that Hans has a plan, a very, very elaborate, well thought out plan that has not yet been derailed. And it is basically never derailed, not until the very, very end. And that's what keeps us watching because we always assume that Hans has one more trick up his sleeve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And just a little thing that stood out. And there also is like, you mentioned the elevator shaft at some point. I was thinking a lot about elevator shafts. Sorry. Anyway, this time watching through, because I feel like elevator shafts were like a really big deal in the 80s and early 90s. Yeah. Like
Mission every Impossible. Movie.
Yeah. Mission Impossible, like Silence of the Lambs and
Matrix later.
The Matrix.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
There's so many elevator shafts and people like climbing up them or falling down them or standing on top and looking through the thing.
Throwing bombs down.
I mean, it's a visually
them.
Cool thing in a big office building. Like, how can you not take advantage of it?
It's a domestic thing that most people experience on either a day-to-day basis or a fairly regular basis. And it's a very dangerous thing.
Right.
So it's the same. It's like arachnophobia or something. It's like, hey, this thing that's everywhere, what if it could kill you, basically? And I think an elevator shaft is the perfect, like, I mean, just like a car chase, right? It's like, what is a thing you do every day that actually, if something went wrong, is terrifying? As opposed to if your entire setting is on a battlefield or something, none of that is familiar to most viewers, right? But then when you take something sort of domestic, especially something domestic that has the potential for risk as an elevator shaft or a car or a bus or something, then that sort of like that hits our sweet spot.
Mm. Yeah.
I also feel like in addition to inspiring a lot of other movie tropes, Die Hard also just, it was like, wow, everybody who made video games after this, like any like shooter video game, they're basically just making Die Hard. Like there's the spaces you have to crawl through in so many games are so similar to the spaces that John McClane has to crawl through. And it's just this building's unfinished for some reason. So there's kind of industrial unfinished walls and things. That's a very video gamey thing. So that was just also fun to see kind of a whole generation, I think, of game makers making like first person shooters. I think all have Die Hard, in their unconscious minds as they're making these games.
Yeah.
Well, it's just a really simplistic construction thing with a skyscraper, which is the doors are only on the bottom floor. Like, if you could have an equally enormous building, I don't know, something big and sprawling like a school or a hospital potentially that has multiple buildings. And it's so much harder for containment. Like the containment piece is just more difficult logistically because there's more doors. Like it's a huge campus, there's probably going to need to be a fence around it, or there's going to be 1,000 more doors just logically. And when you have a skyscraper and the terrorists control the bottom floor, then you have a lot of space to play in, but the containment piece is already done for you. When I was thinking of pitching a containment video on for lessons from the screenplay. I was thinking about Panic Room, and Panic Room does a really good job with containment, but even they have more logistical problems because it's a regular old house. And regular houses have more exits, and like the second floor is still not like a problem. You can still get out a second floor window, right? In the same way that you simply cannot go out a 30th floor window. It just doesn't work that way. And so, you know, you have a lot more sort of just like containment holes to plug in other kinds of buildings. And so a skyscraper is just a really smart one. A plane is another one. And that's why Air Force One, you know, is another like very classic Die Hard. It's the containment is already done for you. Like it's done. Boats are the same way. Speed is the same way.
Also, yeah. Die Hard 2 is Die Hard on a plane.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think I said Con Air earlier, but I meant Air Force One. I haven't seen Con Air. I don't know if it actually is what I'm thinking it is. But Air Force One 100% is the, you know, the guy, right. The guy whose job this is not. This is not his job to be doing this, but he is in a contained space and there are bad guys.
But what if he was the president of the United States?
Exactly.
Get off my plane.
Yeah. Just exactly. That's such a great line. Like, I feel compelled to say that often, but there's no context in which that makes any sense or I would need to say that, but I want more opportunities to tell people.
And don't say it on a plane.
I was going to say, not a good thing to say to anybody on a plane.
So the one time you could say it, you definitely should not. Right?
The great tragedy.
Maybe if you're like on a flat surface with somebody.
No, Brian.
or in a wood shop.
Beautiful.
Oh my goodness.
I love geometric humor.
All right, I'll leave.
Happy holidays, everybody.
You know what's hard? Trying to rob Nakatomi Tower on Christmas Eve. You gotta take out some guards, shut down elevators, ask an executive for the password to the vault even though you don't really need it because you already have a backup plan, hope the FBI cuts power exactly when you need them to, blow up the helicopter pad with the hostages, and hope that no one notices an ambulance being driven out of the parking garage by a bunch of bad guy looking dudes. And that's all before some Bruce Willis-y cowboy throws a wrench into the mix. You know what's easy? And honestly, a much better use of your time? Sending files with Massive. Massive is a file sharing service that lets media professionals quickly transfer terabytes of data to anyone in the world over the cloud. With Massive, there are no limits to the amount of data you can send, and Massive has 150 servers worldwide, which means that whoever you're sending the file to will be able to download it at a maximum unthrottled speed. Transfers are encrypted, so no one but the sender and recipient can access the files. Not even Theo, Hans Gruber's tech specialist guy that loves to kick computers and smash servers or something. And drill. Why does he drill? And sending files with Massive is super simple. You don't need a subscription to sign up or a complicated IT setup. Just pay as you go at 25 cents per gigabyte. To learn more and to sign up for Massive, head to massive.io/beyond-the-screenplay. When you sign up at that link, you'll get 100 gigabytes free towards your transfer. Once again, that's massive.io/beyond-the-screenplay for 100 gigabytes free. The link is also in the show notes. Thank you to Massive for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. Now, back to the episode.
Speaking of holidays, should we talk about whether or not Die Hard is a Christmas movie?
I suppose we should.
Who wants to start?
There's literally an entire YouTube video essay about this because I looked it up. And it's just like, it literally is like a list, you know, a list essay of here's like the six requirements for a Christmas movie. Does Die Hard fulfill them? I think its conclusion was basically it does. But it's hard because what is a Christmas movie? It's a feeling beyond.
Of course. I think,
to me, there's like a scientific breakdown of it takes place during Christmas. And there is some Christmas music in it. And there are Christmas decorations. And
Christmas
there is heartwarming family stuff.
In the score, which I did not pick up on before. But like the score is like a dark version of,
And so for me, maybe if it was associated with Christmas in my childhood, because that also is a big part of it, I think maybe people's feelings about it is if it was watched during the holiday season at a certain age, there's like an imprint of that where it's just like, no, this is, if people are like emotional about it being a Christmas movie, I imagine it has to be somewhat tied in with that kind of association. I don't know if I get Christmas movie feelings personally from this movie, enough for me to feel like this is like alongside my other Christmas feels movies. I think it's fun that it has a lot of Christmas things in it, mm-hmm. but so do a lot of movies. So that's where I stand currently. How about you guys?
Like, I couldn't care less either way.
right. Does it matter?
But yep. I will say that
that's
I do
right
think...
answer.
Yeah.
I think it does help that it ends on such a, like, lovely kind of magical note. Like, I was just thinking, like, yes. if you did watch this back to back with, like, A Muppet Christmas Carol, they do kind of end in a similar way. There's almost, you know, there's, like, a... there's, like, a symbolic, you know, marriage kind of at the end. That's almost like christened by the murder of Carl, who's still alive somehow. And Carl Winslow has to shoot him, and he's yeah. learned his lesson about killing people. I don't know, but it does kind of end with a little bit of like magic and like optimism of like, and then they lived happily ever after, which I think kind of feels Christmassy.
The video essay also mentioned that like there's papers falling like right. in that snow. Final scene. It's almost like snow falling. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think then it plays Let It Snow or something at the end.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely ends on Christmas for yeah. sure.
I mean, the movie takes place on Christmas Eve, and it's a movie about family and someone who was estranged from his family and learns, you know, that the value of admitting he was wrong in order to be yeah. reunited with his family. That's a Christmas theme. For sure. I mean, I don't care either, really. But like, I think that it's something I enjoy watching at Christmas time. There's a really interesting, I mean, really what this is all speaking to is this sort of, you know, just a classic paradoxical fascination with elements that seem like they don't go together that make something feel unique and fun. Right. And so like this is not the only action Christmas movie out there. Shane Black, as everyone knows, is obsessed
with
making.
He's made like three.
He's made, yeah. I think he's made more than three. He is obsessed with making four. Like yeah. action Christmas movies. And I like Shane Black's action Christmas movies a lot. And you know, there's the darkness of like the violence. I mean, which is something we probably should talk about in this movie. This is a very violent film. The violence, the R-rated language, right? Like it's something that you actually can't watch with your kids, but that has a little bit of that holiday flavor to it. Is just that same. It's just the same enjoyment that we as a culture get from like an irreverence, right? Seeing things mm-hmm. that are not mm-hmm. traditionally paired together, being paired together. And it's like, hey, isn't it a little bit fun? You can watch this after the kids go to bed, right? Like, isn't it a little bit entertaining to be irreverent about what, you know, what we think of as a sacred time, usually in family and Christmas and holidays, all of that stuff. And so I wouldn't say this movie invented it, but it certainly has spawned a lot of copycats. And it was one of the original elements, like maybe the most important element that they insisted upon carrying over from the book, which is like LA Christmas and LA Christmas in itself is its own juxtaposition where it's
right.
like,
oxymoron.
Oxymoron. It is certainly not cold here. Like it is not ever going to be like the, you know, New England Christmas that when we have right, LA right. and it's palm trees and we're all at the beach and whatever, although, you know, it's very cold and rainy today, but most of the time it certainly does not in any way feel like a traditional Northern Hemisphere Christmas in Los Angeles. Especially, yeah, again, Christmas is a time in literature and especially in film that we associate with returning to the small hometown that you're from and, you know, going back to this sort of like idyllic, rustic, agrarian, like root to your society and whatever, like getting in touch with your, you know, grandparents and things that are wholesome. And LA is urban and it certainly has no reverence for the past. And is certainly not about not about any of the traditional like wholesome, at least not the way that it's portrayed in film. Right? There's cities and parts of the country have associations with them in American cinema, and Los Angeles does not have any sort of like familial, warm, fireside family associations with it in cinema. And so
the Fast and Furious franchise is working on it.
Fast and the Furious, God bless. I hope so.
We're family.
But yeah, it's just borrowing language, right? It's borrowing cultural language and cultural shorthand to create a fun and irreverent juxtaposition.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that I agree with everything everyone said. Ultimately, I don't care. And I think that it also just depends on what your definition is of a Christmas movie, right? Like, nobody ever says that when they're like, we have this argument. It's like saying, like, is peanut butter good? It's like, well, it depends on whether you like it. It's like, it's, you know, like, right. That is up to you. It's not up to me. You know, and I think it's like, if you think a Christmas movie is a movie set during Christmas that references the fact that it's Christmas, great, then it's a Christmas movie. If you think a Christmas movie is like every single element of the movie is, or every single, yeah, it is like echoing Christmas and about Christmas and everything, then like, no, like most Christmas movies are not ones you watch after the kids go to bed. They're ones you watch with the kids and then you watch Die Hard or whatever. And so, yeah, that's not an argument for or against. It's just, hey, there's different definitions. But I do think one thing that I think about is how much of your script would you have to change to make this not be a Christmas movie? If it's Elf or Christmas Vacation or Miracle on 34th Street, like, you're talking page one rewrite, like, you know, this character who is this now has to be this, and, you know, everything has to be kind of fiddled around. This movie, you could change, I don't know, 12 lines and like the setting, and, you know, that doesn't mean that there aren't still themes that are maybe associated with Christmas and that kind of thing, but like, you wouldn't have to do a lot to make this movie have nothing to do with Christmas. And again, that doesn't mean it's not a Christmas movie. It just means it's not a Christmas movie in the same way other movies are Christmas movies, for better or for worse.
It's a really important conversation we're having, guys. Yes. Getting to the bottom of this.
Discussing things.
Yeah. Look, if we didn't talk about this, then we'd be on the naughty list with our listeners.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Like,
I made the joke at the beginning about this is Home Alone for grown-ups, but I think it is. Like, I think the same fun that you have watching Home Alone, you kind of have watching Die Hard as a grown-up, and that I do think the context of this is at Christmas does the same thing that it does in Home Alone, a little bit of like, oh, you're away from your family. You should be with your family at this time of year. So it gives you that extra little, you know, juice squeeze there. But
right.
Yeah.
Why don't we move to lessons and what lessons we're each going to take away from Die Hard? Alex, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Yeah. We haven't talked much about him, but I love the character of Sergeant Al Powell. Mm-hmm. Just as, you know, it's a really smart choice, I think, to give the hero this ally who is kind of like a comrade who believes in him, who's a great contrast to all these suits, you know, who don't believe in this, the New York street cop, you know, the feds and the, I don't know, whatever rank the other kind of guy in the suit is. That always just immediately, you're rooting for the Sam and Frodo, you're rooting for the buddies who like know the truth, who are right about everything, but the boss won't listen to them. And it also helps that, you know, John McClane now has somebody to talk to, isn't just stuck by himself. And there's like a real warmth between them, like right from the beginning. It's like, hey, I see you, man. Like, you're a fellow, like, peer. I get you. And at the end, I think it's so funny when they see each other. I feel like it's more romantic than anything with John and Holly. And like, if you watch the frame when he goes and hugs Al, like, she's just kind of left. She's on like the left side of the frame, just like left by herself. And she kind of like looks down, like, what do I do with myself now that like they've met and they've like, they're making eye contact and they're really happy to see each other. So I just love their bromance. And I just think it's one of the more delightful parts of this film. And I think it is very helpful and necessary for kind of that second half of the movie when there is this, all this back and forth, this politics with the feds and with the police. And it helps to have that ally for John, who we also like.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I also love that his boss, the police chief, is the principal from The Breakfast Club. Who,
yeah.
Right. Like,
playing the same character. Yeah.
Right. The 80s was not a good decade for him dealing with people named John crawling through vents under his watch. It's just a very specific problem.
The reporter guy is like the asshole from Ghostbusters also, who just like can only be that guy. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, Alex. I was thinking a lot about that this time around. And there's this really sort of interesting examination of like the masculinity of both John McClane and Al Powell and their like roles as cops, but as family men and the way that they see themselves. Right. And I find it really fascinating that John McClane gives his like cathartic, tearful confession about what he's done wrong in his marriage to Al. Right. Like it's
not to
his
wife.
He never says that to Holly, not in the movie. Right. He just like it confesses to Al that he, you know, always said, I love you, but never said he was sorry. And like that he knew that he had made a mistake, but was too proud to admit it. Right. Like all of this stuff. And I think it's this really fascinating, like, I don't know, examination of the way that these men interrelate and think about themselves, right? Because ultimately, that's kind of the redemption that Al gets at the end of it, right? He thinks of himself as like a failure as a cop, right? He's like, I couldn't do one of the basic things required of a cop. Just drawing my gun on people.
not shooting a kid.
Right.
It's the bar that we have.
Correctly assessing threats. Right. Let's put it that way. I couldn't do one of the basic requirements as a cop, and therefore I am a failure, right? Like he doesn't think of himself as being good at his job anymore, and yet we can see that he is very good at his job. Everything we see from him is that he's way better at his job than literally every person around him, and his instincts are dead on about everything. And so the sort of redemption that he gets at the end of this by killing Carl in a very cartoonish way is just about trusting his own judgment, right? Like he was put off trusting his instincts by this incident that happened where he made a bad call. And then he's like put back in a position of being able to trust his own judgment again and protect people that he cares about. And that's kind of not the same journey that John McClane is on, but I do think there's a really clear parallel happening where, you know, Al's wife is pregnant and John also is a father. And there are these very clear parallels of like, you know, John's not afraid to run into action. Actually, he's very afraid to run into action, but like he's going to do the right thing because he's the only one who can. Right. And so when you're called upon to act, can you act? That's sort of the question that John is dealing with, and it's the question that Al is dealing with too. And for that reason, I think they really see each other. And you know, this movie has plenty of, I'm gonna put this, dated thematic content. And certainly some of that is mixed in here. But I also think that there's something cathartic that we feel because it is well observed and feels like true about their relationship. It's textually their relationship is textually parallel and resonant thematically. So John's arc is not disconnected completely from Al's arc and vice versa.
Yeah, I think there's a good faith reading of all this. You know, there's a way to be snarky about it all and be like, yeah, you can look at it with 2021 eyes, but there is a sweetness to their story. And I think there's a good faith way to engage with it, even if it does feel dated.
Yeah.
Brian, what's your lesson?
My lesson was going to be about the exposition, but we covered it a lot in the early on. I was thinking a lot about how, you know, because this is always just called action movie, action movie, action movie. It's the main genre people put this in. But I was thinking about how much it's also a suspense movie, almost like a thriller. Yeah, thriller is not even the right word because we associate that with kind of a different kind of genre. But there's so much, because there's a finite number of bad guys, as you were saying, Tricia, there's like one good guy on the inside and there's like, what, like eight bad guys or something?
Originally
like maybe 12. 12 originally, but that like goes down pretty quickly to about 8 for the most of the movie, I think. So you can't just have shootouts all day and you have zero car chases, you know, when you are in a skyscraper, and not sort of the traditional action where we just think like just have a crazy thing happen and have someone chase someone else and punch Hugo Weaving, but there's a lot of them. But instead it's like putting John in these impossible situations, right? Where he's like the elevator shaft and the air ducts and the fire hose jump and walking on broken glass. And it's just like, I realized that maybe that is why so many action movies feel boring. Like, you know, that feeling, especially as you get older, where you're just like, during the action scenes is when you kind of don't care and you're waiting for like the talking scenes to come out. You're like, when did that happen? When did I turn that age?
Totally. It freaks me out.
Right. But I realize a lot of the reason for that probably is because there's very little tension in a lot of action sequences. It's just now you're going to watch things happen and there's stakes, but there's not necessarily tension. And this movie is just full of tension, full of if he turns his head 5 degrees more, he's going to see me and then everything, you know, goes to hell. Or if like finding out that Holly is important, you know, Holly is such an important character in this movie. We haven't even talked about her, but like the fact that she's right between John and Hans, and like we are spending basically the entire second act hoping that like, are they going to figure out who John is? Are they going to figure out who Holly is? They're going to figure out all this kind of stuff. So it's like the tension of all of that is as, if not more, compelling to us than the fact that we get to see some cool action sequences along the way.
Right.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the question is never like, is John going to die right now? Because we know on a meta level that he's not. But there are, as you're pointing out, plenty of things that can go wrong that can hurt him either physically or emotionally. And those are very much on the table. And yeah, I think that's when action scenes are actually compelling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this movie follows the make it worse rule, where those things do happen. He does get physically hurt. He does get emotionally hurt, right? It's such a simple device, but you take the shoes away from the hero and he can really get hurt. It's a big deal, right? Like, it's just the basic stripping away of like tools and resources until he literally doesn't even have clothes, right? Like you take away all of his tools and resources and make it worse. And the bad guy knows exactly who his wife is and exactly who his kids are and is then holding all of the cards by the end. And that's just really basic, but really smart writing.
And all the things you just listed, those don't all just happen at once. There's a pacing thing where it's not like in the first act, Hans Gruber finds out who his wife is and she's just sitting there being a hostage the whole time. Because after a while, you would just be like, okay, she's not going to die. He would have killed her already. This is kind of boring now. But the fact that we are worried about him finding out about her for so long and then it happens, that's where you want it in the movie. You don't want it up front where then it becomes just, oh, nothing's going to happen because she's going to be fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Trisha, what's your lesson?
Oh, I have so many. I'm going to talk about the death of Mr. Takagi for a second, which I think is really critical to this.
Mr. Takagi won't be joining us for the rest of his life.
So the quote I was hoping for. Thank you, Brian. The death of Mr. Takagi changes everything in the movie because it is so awful the way that Hans Gruber kills him. Like they have, again, with a pacing, there's this whole lead up. Well, hang on, let me back up. We meet Mr. Takagi. He's nice. He's thoughtful. He's super smart. Like we just met Ellis, who is a total jerk, but Mr. Takagi is not. He sees that Holly is an incredibly hard worker and like really values her. She's on the path to promotion and all this stuff in the company. And Takagi is like very personable and he, you know, sent the limo and like he's likable. We only meet him for a couple of minutes, but he's likable. That's crucial. Mm-hmm. We meet Takagi, he's likable. Then the lead up after, well, actually the lead up to Hans figuring out who he is also really clever and smart because Hans is walking around giving like reading Takagi's resume basically and is looking for Takagi to identify himself. And he does. He just steps forward and says, enough. It's me. Again, it's a very noble thing. We like him. That is a good leader, right? He has all of these great leadership qualities to him. And again, he's been set up long enough that we know we care about him. So when he steps forward, we're like, oh no, Mr. Takagi, I hope you're okay. Then they have this whole big long scene where they're wandering around looking at all the models of all the buildings in your cool office, Mr. Takagi, with all of your, there's lots of models. And they're like exchanging, you know, talking about his suit and all of this stuff. And they seem like gentlemen, right? That this is the first real scene we get with Hans Gruber. And he's coming across as essentially a gentleman thief. And we start to think, okay, maybe he's not that violent. Maybe it's going to be one of those movies where he's going to negotiate and maybe there'll be like, he's going to have to knock him around a little bit, but like, it's going to be fine. And then as the negotiation goes on, Takagi insists he doesn't know the information and we believe him, but it doesn't matter because Hans Gruber just shoots him in the head. And it's so unceremonious and also very bloody, that scene. And it completely recontextualizes the entire movie and sets the tone for the rest of the movie. Like, you have to have, it's awful, but you have to have the blood splatter on the window and you have to have John McClane overhear it. And it has to be done with that little concern on Hans Gruber's part where Takagi's like, I don't know. I really don't know what you're going to have to kill me. And he's like, okay. And shoots him in the head. And that signals to us so much. This is how dangerous Hans Gruber is. He truly does not even think twice about taking somebody's life and somebody that we like in a really violent manner. And that's kind of what the rest of the movie becomes, is we understand how formidable he is as an opponent to John. And then we also understand how bloody the rest of this movie is about to get. And how many people are about to get killed, basically. It's just, it's doing a lot of tonal work. It's doing a lot of character work. It's a really pivotal scene. Poor Mr. Takagi. But it's good, smart screenwriting.
Yeah.
Another death, this isn't a lesson, but another death that is just so good in this movie is Hans Gruber's death. And just the shot of his face as he falls is like a beautiful shot. And like the just the performance in that moment is beautiful. And it's an amazing payoff for a setup at the end of the movie with the Rolex watch. Just how perfect, almost thematically too. Like,
of course,
letting go of the watch. Yeah, it's just great. So that continues to be one of my favorite just death moments for any villain. There's something just magical about that shot of him falling.
Well, and we've never seen him surprised. Like, that's the thing, is that Hans Gruber doesn't get surprised. It's a different expression. Yeah, it's so, it's really satisfying.
Yeah. My lesson is, as we've talked about, the pacing in this movie is, I think, perfect.
Yeah.
Like, that was something I was thinking about while watching it. I was like, wow, this pacing is good. It might be perfect. It might be the exact right pacing for this story. And as someone who's, read a lot of screenwriting books, I can see where a lot of these lessons came from. I think of like looking at Die Hard and when it decides to interrupt the exposition with the bad guys are coming, right? The van is here. Something bad is going to happen. So now we're like, okay, we got to lean in, but we're still going to exposition, but now we know something bad is happening. And then revealing the bad guys. And then, action scenes. John's doing things, but then Carl Winslow shows up and he's part of the story now, right? We have that plot thread. Then we get the news guy at some point, which is like, every time it happens, I'm 30 seconds into the scene where suddenly we're in a newsroom, I'm like, why are we here? What's happening? And why am I not more bothered by this? But I think it's because it comes at exactly the right time where we need something else. Yep. And we're still open to what the movie's going to throw at us, and that it does create its own little mini story thread that pays off and like has to do with thematic things and John's family and all this stuff. So it makes me want to rewatch this movie and study it scene by scene, because it really does feel like every progression is happening just right on time and either developing things or bringing in something new at just the right moment to keep the flow going. And that's just such It's a very difficult thing to do, and it is marvelous when it works. And I think that is what makes this feel like such a fun, easy breezy ride of a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen this movie several times, but I haven't seen it so many times that I remember exactly when like the scene is happening or whatever. So I just remember so much happens in the first, 45 minutes of this movie. And I remember going like, there's an hour and 20 minutes. Like what happens between now and like the big finale? Cause I feel like everything is already happening and then it just keeps going. And again, that doesn't mean look at all this action. It means just look at scenes that are compelling for one reason or another, whether it's a scene between a reporter and somebody or an action scene or whatever. And like you said, it's just, you never have a moment where you're just kind of sitting back waiting for the next, we need to get back to John McClane because the other scenes are as compelling, and that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Good movie, despite, as I said, being an 80s movie. Yeah, they did it. We'll say like the biggest hump for me was like, John comes in and he's like putting the name into the computer in the lobby and he's like, cute toy. And then the security guard guy is like, yeah, if you have to take a leak, it'll help you find the zipper. I'm like, that, I don't know that I can like any movie that has that line in it. That's just such a barrier to entry for me. But it pulls it out.
But then you should watch Die Hard with a Vengeance.
It pulls it out.
It's Die Hard with a Vengeance, solidly mid-90s, 1995 movie. And then, just as good, Sam Jackson, Jeremy Irons, Bruce Willis, obviously, I recommend.
I remember seeing the trailer for it. I feel like I know these movies based on their trailer. He has, mm-hmm. his daughter is grown up at one point.
Yeah. No. That's
the next one.
That's Live Free or Die Hard. That's like the,
okay, yeah, four.
The Die Hard trilogy is done and we're still making Die Hard movies.
Right. Yeah. That's, anyway.
That's when Die Hard became PG-13.
Right.
Which sparked mm-hmm. a real, real departure.
Yeah.
Very, right. Very interesting direction they went.
Excellent. Okay, cool. Well, quickly, what have you guys been watching recently? Brian, what have you been watching recently?
I saw The French Dispatch, the new Wes Anderson movie. And when I say new, I mean the movie we all saw the trailer for 18 months ago and then
right.
for reasons did not come out until a few weeks ago. And boy, it's Wes Anderson going full Wes Anderson. It's the plot, if it matters, is that there's a newspaper. I mean, it doesn't. In the town of Ennui, France.
No.
which is near the River Blasé. Sure. There is a newspaper called The French Dispatch. Bill Murray is the editor. He dies suddenly of a heart attack. And the people who work for him are writing a final issue of the newspaper, which is the movie that you're watching. So you watch in the same way Royal Tenenbaums is like a book that you are being told. So each article that is being written by like Owen Wilson's character and Tilda Swinton's character is like a 25 minute short with its own cast of characters. So it's like you get three Wes Anderson short films wrapped up in this sort of frame story that's holding it all together. And yeah, as I just hinted at, this huge cast of returning Wes Anderson alums and then a whole bunch of newcomers, just this like enormously diverse cast of white people and also Benicio and Jeffrey Wright, so that helps. Speaking of the cast, the first segment, there's two prison guards and I was looking at one of them and I'm like, where do I recognize him from? Oh, it's the father from the beginning of Inglourious Bastards from that opening sequence.
Oh, nice.
He's great.
Yeah.
But then the other prison guard is Lea Seydoux, who's one of his daughters in that sequence. And then
weird.
Christoph Waltz shows up in the second segment of the movie. What? So, what better way to fill your movie with whimsy and delight than to remind everyone of the hilarious opening scene. Yeah. Ultimately, is it a good movie? It's at its best, it's delightful and entertaining. And at its worst, it's just overwrought and sort of alienating and kind of forgettable. Like by the third segment, I forgot what the first segment was about. And that's not helpful. But the nice thing is each segment is its own story. So you don't feel like this movie has 80 actors you've heard of in it, but like each one is only in their own little segment. So at least that is not alienating, but it's just, I think the reviewers said, if you like Wes Anderson movies, you will like this movie. If you don't, it's fine. And I think that is accurate. So I recommend it if you are in the mood for Wes Anderson doing Wes Anderson.
All right. Cool. Well, yeah, that sounds right. Excellent. Trisha, what have you been watching recently?
So I saw Benedetta, which is Paul Verhoeven's new movie. Which is the lesbian nun movie, which I trust you've heard about. And it's really great. I really enjoyed it. It's Virginie Efira, who I've seen in a couple different things already. She's wonderful in it. Daphne Patakia, I'm sure I'm saying all these names wrong. Lambert Wilson, our best friend, the Merovingian, is also in it.
Yes. I saw him in the trailer and I was so excited.
He's so good. And of course, the goddess herself, Charlotte Rampling. It's a movie that takes place in French and it's set in like the 15th century. And it's about this nun who starts having visions of Jesus and then also gets into a sexual relationship with like one of the like young nuns at the abbey. And it's like there's miracles happening. And is it magic? Is it all in her mind? Is she manipulating it? Is it real? Is anyone going to find out about all of that? It's Paul Verhoeven. So lots of nudity. It's great. That's all I'll have to say about that.
I really want to see it.
No,
I really want to see
it. Like, it's so good. I mean, it checks a lot of my boxes anyway, because it's like a period thing with like religious, like sort of examinations of like ritual and superstition and politics. And it gets into all of that. And yeah, it's also just really goofy and also like horrifying at different moments. And like, it's great. So yes, Benedetta, yes. It's out now.
I Googled lesbian nun movie and that didn't come up. So I'll have to keep looking. But
everyone Google that and see what happens.
Yeah. To be fair, I think there are excellent. A few.
Alex, what have you been watching?
So I went and saw Come On, Come On, which is the new movie by Mike Mills. It's a really lovely movie. All the reviews have been saying it's just, what a delight, a delightful movie that's very realistic, really honest about just what it's like to raise a child, basically. And the joys and the horrors of it. And it's about Joaquin Phoenix stars as basically an uncle in the movie who's taking care of his nephew for a week or two. And Gabby Hoffman plays his sister. She's great. But man, the kid who plays the nephew, Woody Norman, he is amazing. He's so natural, such a kind of captivating young actor to watch on screen. Joaquin Phoenix does his usual kind of like, I'm a mumbly guy who kind of mumbles my way through things. But it works. It totally works for his character here. I definitely recommend it as if you just want to, kind of have a slice of life, naturalistic, ultimately tear-jerking little movie. It's very nice. Come On, Come On.
Nice.
Awesome. Very cool.
Really want to see that.
I listened to a podcast series.
You don't say.
So Radiolab is one of my favorite shows of all time. And they did a 5-part series called Mixtape that is kind of about and surrounding the invention of the cassette tape. And it's a piece of technology that we don't think about anymore, but essentially changed the world. And so it's these 5 episodes examining all the different ways that the ability to record something and play it back to yourself, essentially, changed the world in really interesting ways. So from anything for just like the Sony Walkman, where, believe it or not, kids, there used to not be a way to just listen to music by yourself. Like,
while you're out in the world. And they talk about the first time, like the press release of the Sony Walkman. And just suddenly there was like hundreds of people all wearing these headphones and listening to music together, but separately. And the ability to like customize what you're listening to, and also how it allowed for editing and editing audio. It's much easier to deceive people than when you're editing video. There's no way to tell if you edit audio well that it's been edited. And so looking back at like Bing Crosby and the first time people edited something to make it sound like it was live, and is that morally right or is it wrong? It talks about like war and this really like kind of disturbing and upsetting but fascinating way sound mixing and kind of sound design for the first time was used in the Vietnam War against the people of Vietnam. And it's a really interesting look at all the ways just sound affects us as people, but also specifically how this technological leap suddenly unlocked all these new ways of communicating and experiencing the world. And I found it to be fascinating and amazing. The editing of the episodes itself are great, and the music is awesome. It's very well produced, as Radiolab usually is. So I highly recommend at least checking out those five episodes because they're pretty cool. So mixtape on Radiolab.
Nice.
Okay, well, we did it. We talked about Die Hard, and now we're here at the end of the year. It's weird.
Yeah.
I'm going to sit and think about that for a minute, reflect on all this time.
It's been a great year for the show. Thank you to everybody who's listening, who's supporting us on Patreon. Like, it's been so rewarding and so much fun to get to know you guys on our Discord channel. And just, it feels like there's a real community that's formed around the show that is just so lovely. So that's been my big takeaway from 2021, is just how much the show has grown, and just the people that we're getting to know through the show has been so lovely.
Feels like we're the luckiest people in the world. At least that's how I feel. I mean, it's, I don't know, very such an honor to be here.
Agreed.
Yeah, absolutely. Many things to be thankful for. We are certainly thankful to all of you for listening to the show and supporting it. And this has been our conversation about Die Hard. Thank you, as always, to the patrons that make this show possible. Thank you to our wonderful producer, Vince Major. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Calleros. And again, on behalf of all of us, I want to say happy holidays, happy Merry Christmas, have a beautiful new year, and we will see you in the next episode. Bye, guys.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Really hoping you were going to say yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, at the end there, Michael.
We'll just put you saying that at the end, Vince.
I don't think it records me, so...
My backup does.
Cuts all around.